Do you know why the Stanley Cup is better than the Lombardi Trophy?
I was waiting for the deluge of posts that we usually see talking about why the Stanley Cup Finals better than the Super Bowl and the Stanley Cup is better than the Lombardi Trophy. I have undoubtedly written that piece, by the way. I think I might have even done like 20 reasons why the Stanley Cup playoffs are better than the Super Bowl. Only because I have a real hankering to peg my news to large non-hockey events. By the way, it's me, Greg. Merrick is still dealing with some personal stuff, and hopefully we'll be back later this week. The Lombardi Trophy is dumb. It's a giant paperweight. It's a giant doorstop. And it does amuse me greatly when they try to give it some get raped by a bear? That's a revenant. Reverence. I think that's the word. Anyways, like they had Joe Willie Namath bring it through the crowd last night, and all the players like to try to give it smooches and stuff. I mean, the basic reason why it's better, obviously, is because you can drink out of the Stanley Cup. It's the only trophy, I think, in pro sports you can drink out of. Although, I'm sure if you poured enough liquid onto the World Series trophy, you could retain some of it. But it's kind of cumbersome. The gold pennants will undoubtedly poke you in the eye. So the Stanley Cup is better than the Lombardi Trophy. Joe Malone writes in, there is only one Stanley Cup and there are numerous replicas each NFL team gets. The NHL, actually, I don't know if you know this, but NHL teams that win the cup get little tiny Stanley Cups. I was once in Lou Lamoriello's office in New Jersey, by happenstance, and they have they had a giant display in the front of all these mini Stanley Cups that the Devils had received. Well, I mean, three of them. I guess that's many. Jerry Kibbe writes in, you get to show the cup off to all your friends and family. The Lombardi goes in a trophy case. Pat Clark, you can debate the better trophy, but the cup and everything in the NHL is romanticized more because of an inferiority complex. I don't think that's true. Like, here's the thing. Like, I'll freely admit that inferiority complex and National Hockey League go hand in hand. That's a peanut butter and jelly type situation. But the cup is something that we can crow about. The cup is something we can actually hold over the heads of other sports and say, we got this right. This is the thing that you covet. You wish you had something as cool as this. I don't think that's inferiority complex. Although I will admit that maybe we do put a little extra mustard on it knowing that it's that cool. I don't know. It's fun to see other sports try to treat their trinket, their trophy with some like it's a giant honor, like the thing is the holy grail of whatever sport it is. Like even the World Cup looks like it's a piece of melted scrap metal. But the Stanley Cup lives on, perpetuity. Bubba Banjo, of course Stanley is better. God gave it to Lord Stanley like Moses. Flaming poutine led the way. Do five Hail Tim Hortons and penance. Bubba Banjo, legendary Yahoo commenter. Couple things about the Super Bowl. Then we got Chris Johnson coming up, and we got Ryan Lambert coming up as well on the program today, talking puck. The first thing is the Cam Newton stuff from last night was bothersome. Pretty bothersome, to be honest with you. Like, and I don't mean his behavior. I mean the reaction of people to his behavior. In that press conference. Like even our own Eric Adelson, who's a friend and a really great writer, called him the incredible sulk. And I mean, when you're as loud as Cam Newton has been in the lead up to this with the Superman stuff and the dab, you know, the whole thing, I get it. I get the fact that you want the loudest mouth to be shut up. And then when he shuts up, then you're going to kill him for it. I get that. Like I said last night, it kind of reminded me, the way he acted in that press conference, kind of reminded me of when Ryan Miller lost in Vancouver. Like, when Ryan Miller, in the lead-up to that gold medal game, in which Canada won gold, even though the U.S. had won on aggregate points for the tournament, Ryan Miller was just the best. He was the best! He was the guy who got it, he exuded patriotism, he was the best quote in the room, he was a guy who would speak to you for hours on end in the lead-up to the gold medal game. And throughout the tournament, about goaltending, about this tournament, seizing the moment, the whole thing. And then at the end of that game, when he went through the scrum, when he went through the mix zone, as they call it, after the gold medal game, my God, it was death stares. It was sullen. It was, the petulant Ryan Miller that I think a lot of folks have kind of seen remain the Ryan Miller through his stops in Buffalo and St. Louis, and now at times in Vancouver. And that reminded me of Cam Newton last night. But the two things about the Cam Newton stuff last night. The first is that the setup of that press conference must have been insane for him. I was watching it on TV, and I guess it was confirmed by some reporters. He's at one table speaking to a giant crowd of people. There's a Denver player with an earshot of Cam Newton basically trashing him, basically trashing the Panthers passing game, trashing the Panthers as far as them, you know, not being ready for prime time. And like, while Cam Newton is trying to answer these questions and, you know, doing it very, you know, with very few words, he hears the echoing of this Denver player a couple stalls over trashing his team. So not only does he have to answer inane questions to the media,
how does it feel to have your band of brothers fall like this if you're all a band of brothers?
He's got to hear some guy who just beat him in the Super Bowl crowing about the victory over a loudspeaker a few stalls over. So I don't blame him for leaving. I do blame everybody giving him a hard time for it, though, when you consider Peyton Manning left the field when the Saints beat Peyton Manning. He left the field and didn't shake the Saints players' hands. And I remember at the time when this went down, I think it was 2010, I remember at the time when this went down, the reaction was, well, he's such a competitor. I mean, honestly, what can you expect out of the man? He was a competitor. Now, I'm sure this probably has more to do with attitude than, you know, that other stuff, right? But one guy acts sullen and sulky and petulant in a defeat, and it's just his competitive fire coming out, and the other guy is treated like he's an immature child who, you know, needed to be the bigger man. Okay, sure, whatever. Hockey time. Joining us now on the line is our good friend from Sportsnet, Chris Johnston. He's an insider. Are you still an insider, technically?
I don't know. It's not my contract. I think I'm a senior hockey writer in my contract. So
I always get confused who gets... Yeah, whoever gets...
I feel like
you know,
the insider tag's thrown around a lot, so I don't know what it means.
Is it thrown out around a lot? Because I always feel like there's only a few honored individuals that get the insider tag in Canada.
That's true, but I even see, like, you know, Cavaliers insider, and, you know, it just seems like it's kind of become ubiquitous across sports in general, so I don't know.
Yeah. It always amused me when I would go on NBC, when Yahoo used to have a show on NBC, and they would refer to me as NHL insider Greg Wyshynski, and it's like, well, basically I look at what the insiders are writing, and then I make snarky comments around those quotes. So I'm not sure if I can technically qualify as an insider myself.
Well, again, if they're giving it to you, you should take it. So
yeah, you're probably right.
In the eye of the beholder a little bit.
CJ, I guess the big story over the weekend are two teams that were complete dog poo earlier in the season that are now playing much better hockey, the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Anaheim Ducks, who in fact meet tonight. What is your take on the return of these two darling teams to prominence here in the second half of the season?
Well, I'm happy to see it, frankly. I mean, it's to me, this has been this week, first week out of the All-Star break that we've just been through, was the most exciting week of the season for me. I mean, it might just be my impression, but having, you know, Sidney Crosby back on top and obviously putting together a 10-game point streak and then really lifting Pittsburgh. You know, he was instrumental in their comeback win in Florida on the weekend. And then, you know, Connor McDavid returning. Eric Karlsson's doing his thing in Ottawa. And you have a team like the Ducks who, you know, were really perplexing for the first half of the season with their inability to score and you know, generate any positive things going their way. You know, after last season, you know, could have beat the Blackhawks and maybe won the Stanley Cup, game within one game of doing that. I mean, it just feels like maybe some order has been restored, and, you know, it's good kind of, you know, these teams face each other twice a year, and it's kind of fortuitous that they end up playing now when they're both kind of back on the high streak and doing well.
And obviously the loser of this game will spiral out into a 6 or 7 game losing streak, and then, you know, the other one will have sucked the life energy from the losing team tonight and go on a, like a 12 game winning streak. That's obviously how it has to go. What, anything off the top of your mind as far as why the Ducks all of a sudden are scoring? Cause it's as if a switch has been flipped.
Nothing too insightful, but I do think that it was probably bound to happen, and, you know, maybe a little bit of a boring answer, but they certainly weren't as bad as they looked for a lot of the season. And, you know, Ryan Getzlaff would have like one empty net goal. It felt like forever. And then, you know, they just weren't getting it done. And I do think on some level it was bound to happen, but, it's been certainly a welcome change because, they needed it, and they're fortunate, I think, to play in the Pacific Division, and it's allowed them really to get back into it, and where we would probably be surprised now if they miss the playoffs. But I don't think that there's any magic recipe to it, other than they have some really good players, and that's one thing that didn't change. And, you know, I think they started getting a little bit more bounces going their way.
Yeah, indeed. Puck luck, as it's called here.
I know it's boring, but I really don't believe it's anything deeper than that. I don't think that all of a sudden they're trying harder or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing as Sid, though. Like, Lambert wrote about this morning about how, you know, in Sid's case, it's now pucks are going in. It's like, you hate to make it that simple. And there are some other factors involved there. And obviously, the firing of Johnston, you know, factors into all of this. With his points per game before and after Johnson got there. But at the same time, it's like the puck's going in. That's the big thing.
Well, and the good thing for Sid, and I think Lambert did mention this, I read his piece this morning, that, you know, he is generating more shots now. He seems to be, you know, feeling it a little bit more offensively. So, you know, by any measure, he's going to score more when he's doing more of that. And he's been, you know, I will say, the criticism of him early in the year, I think, was justified. I was in Pittsburgh for a couple games in October, and it just didn't seem like the same guy that you know, you're used to seeing. He just, you know, wasn't driving play in any meaningful way. Whereas, you know, if you watch the game against the Panthers, there was almost a feeling of inevitability to it. I mean, Crosby was everywhere. I believe he had 7 or 8 shots on net in the game. He had 2 primary assists on the goals. He scored the other one. I mean, he was, you know, he's basically one of the best players, or if not still the best player in the world, which is what people had expected. And, you know, he did get off to a terrible start. And, you know, I don't think that anyone was too unfair in their criticism of him for that. But, you know, for him now to be at this stage in the season and be back to a point of game player inside the top 10 in scoring, I mean, that's a pretty amazing turnaround. And if he keeps his hot run going, I mean, it could be a nearly historic type of turnaround, depending on how high he can climb those charts.
You know, it's funny, like, if, I think the Penguins deserve a lot of criticism for bringing Johnston in, you know, a guy with no NHL experience who's going to come in and try to change the way they play to get them more playoff ready. But at the same time, like, you got to give him credit, because Sullivan's not a guy that I would have looked at and said, oh yeah, he's the play, the coach you need to unlock the offensive potential of this team. And yet it seems like the right hire, for this group right now.
Right. I mean, it was a pretty awkward transition in general when they fired Ray Shiro and initially kept Dan Bylsma. And, you know, that summer was a bit messy. And you know, if you remember, you know, Mike Johnston wasn't even their first choice. They were in trying to get Willie Desjardins, who was hired by the Vancouver Canucks instead. And you know, it seemed to have an impact, I think, on the organization. Whereas now, you know, maybe things have stabilized a little bit. I mean, they're still... They've gone down a degree where kind of every year, I think you had your eye on them thinking, hey, if they get things together the right way, you know, maybe they can win another Stanley Cup. I think now, they're not really seen quite as a contender. I mean, stranger things have happened with the players they have, and with, frankly, Marc-Andre Fleury has been having a pretty solid year, all things considered. You know, but now it would be the sort of narrative around it would be that it's a surprise that they were able to get it done. So, you know, they've probably had to adjust to kind of the realities of getting older. And even though they won one cup, but, you know, I think a feeling that they probably should have done more when they had these guys at the absolute height of their careers. But, you know, now they seem to be able to, under Mike Sullivan, just flip that switch. And, you know, it seems like the atmosphere and the attitude's changed. I mean, I guess it's chicken and egg when you start winning. But, you know, they seem offensively to have been unlocked a little bit in terms of what they're able to do and what they're being encouraged to do. And you're right, Mike Sullivan's kind of known as a defensive coach in his past. But, you know, give him credit for finding a way to get through to these guys.
Very much so. A team that you wrote about recently that hasn't found a way to get through its struggles is the Montreal Canadiens. What's your diagnosis there? We wrote about it last week, the idea that maybe you just shut Carey down, maybe you just write this season off, or do you think there's still a chance for them to kind of rally this thing and make a go of it?
Well, I do think their management is sort of divided. I think that they're not exactly clear on what they want the most, because it's kind of tricky. I mean, they're in a place where, yes, it would be great if they were able to have some luck with the draft lottery, miss the playoffs, and add, you know, another high-end talented player to the organization. But they're also at a period where, you know, P.K. Subban and Carey Price and Max Pacioretty, I mean, these guys are all kind of in their window to try to win a championship. And, you know, as bad as things have been in Montreal for 2 months, and that sometimes blocks out the sun a little bit, let's not forget that they played in 5 playoff series the last 2 years, and they were really not all that far away with a healthy Carey Price from maybe, you know, finding their way to a Stanley Cup final. So it's kind of hard to just simply punt away, you know, one opportunity being this season, even though a lot hasn't gone right for them. My diagnosis, honestly, from watching them, I was in Montreal this weekend and saw both of the afternoon games they played live. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if they got it together and made the playoffs now. You know, they're just not as bad as all that losing looks. And, you know, they really weren't getting many saves. I mean, Mike Condon has, you know, largely handled the duties with, you know, since Price has been out, and, you know, he's at a .905 save percentage. It's among the lowest in the league with goalies that have started 25 games. And, you know, you see it was Ben Scrivens who, you know, I don't obviously envision any long-term answer for the Habs, but he had a good couple games on the weekend, and lo and behold, you know, they win. And I just think that there's still enough talent there to find a way to sneak into the playoffs. I mean, we'll have to see how it shakes out, but it does present some interesting questions, I think, for Mark Bergevin at the deadline, because, you know, I'm not certain that management is rooting for them to finish kind of in the last wild card spot. I think there's maybe a little bit of internal debate just about, you know, what the best course forward is.
And let's talk about that deadline, since you are of course an NHL insider. How do you see Buffalo shaking out? Our colleague Elliot Friedman seems to be banging the drum pretty hard insofar as the Jets making a real run at trying to retain Buffalo, which in my opinion means they're gonna give him the right money, but way too many years. What do you think is going to happen with Buffalo, and I guess conversely also with Andrew Ladd with those Winnipeg Jets?
Well, I don't think you're going to see both of them remain Jets, you know, beyond the 29th. And you know, I would be surprised at this point if Buffalo wasn't re-signed. I think that it's clear the Jets have identified him as the player of the two that they're most comfortable committing, you know, big dollars and big term to. And I do think that, you know, his comments are kind of, they're going to be difficult to read too much into, but I do think that it's a comfortable place for him to play, and it just makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, then I do believe you'll see Andrew Ladd traded, just because, look, I mean, Winnipeg, the troubles that doomed the organization many years ago are still things that are relevant today when we see the Canadian dollar go where it has, potentially we're not at a point yet where people aren't going to games, but, you know, everyone's got to watch their attendance. And, you know, I think that they just have to be a very tight organization where they're run financially. So they just can't afford to pay all these guys, you know, UFA value for them. So, you know, I do think that there's only one that's going to be signed, and I would be surprised if it wasn't Dustin Buffalo. And then I guess you just hold your nose and hope that he can continue to be as elite as he is now. I mean, the reality is that's what happens in a lot of UFA situations. I mean, Anze Kopitar, you know, signing a max-length deal, I mean, he's worth it, because I would think 4 years minimum he's still going to be elite. But, you know, it could, in 5 years' time, look like, oh, man, why does he still have 3 more years? I mean, it tends to be what happens when you give long contracts to guys, you know, at their end of their 20s or early 30s.
And then finally, well, actually not finally, because I got one more after this, but finally, as far as teams looking to make a move, I saw the Minnesota Wild here against the Rangers. They're not a very confident hockey team. They're not a very good hockey team at this point. And the question then becomes, do you expect to see a trade? Or do you think that, you know, I was thinking this morning, we haven't seen many coaches get turf this season. We've seen two, I think. Is there a chance that Mike Yeo might actually meet his end this season in an effort to try to turn this team around?
I would be surprised if they went with the coach thing during the season. I mean, depending on how it plays out at the end of the regular season, all bets are off. with him, with Michelle Therrien, and with a lot of guys around the league. But you know, I think one issue you have with coaching is we don't have exactly a large stable of guys that are out of work that I think teams feel that it's worth making that move for. And you know, it's not to say that there aren't capable coaches out there, but you know, there's just, I don't think any sort of buzz guys that teams are anxious and feeling a need to you know, make a move to make sure they secure. And you know, that's probably why, you know, I think it's entirely possible nobody is fired from now until the last game of the regular season, and then you might see the musical chairs that typically seems to happen, you know, early in the off season. But you know, for the Wild, they're going to try to get some scoring. I mean, that's been out there for a while, and hope to ride this through. But you know, they're in a difficult situation. I mean, being in the Central Division, it's not quite been as lights out of late as it was early in the year. But you know, it's still a very tough place to do your business. And I just don't think that there's one magic move that can make them suddenly be a team that we see as a contender to come out of that division in the playoff format. So you know, they're going to try to get into the playoffs, but you know, I'm not sure that we should have much greater expectations of them than that.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about is about the much heralded World Cup of Hockey coming up this fall in your dear home of Toronto. So they haven't sold out of tickets. There's lots of tickets available. There's a report from Rick Westhead today talking about how revenue projections for the event have been sort of downgraded a little bit, mostly because of the Canadian dollar, although it's still projected to make more than $100 million. What's your take on this thing? I mean, like, are we so far out from it that we shouldn't really be worried about empty seats and that kind of thing? Or do you think with the way the economy is going and the price of those tickets, that there might be some concern about how financially successful this event could end up being?
There should be some of that concern. I mean, look, this is a huge undertaking, and you know, even though we've had prior sort of versions of an event like it, I mean, it's basically a new event in terms of everything that goes into running it and to creating it. And you know, from any conversations I've had with people involved in doing those things, it's proven to be a lot more work and a lot more complicated, I think, than many of them expected. And you know, as a result of that, you know, I do believe there's probably a little bit less buzz, and it's just not as front of mind because, again, it is essentially a new event that it's first being introduced now. I mean, I'd be surprised if we saw very many empty seats by the time it got to that period. I mean, right now they're still selling the ticket packages where you have to buy tickets for the whole tournament as opposed to a game-by-game kind of situation. And, you know, clearly once they, you know, loosen that up and start selling individual game tickets, you're going to see more of those be moved. But, you know, it's not a guarantee slam dunk that it's going to be this massive success because, look, it's going to be in Toronto in September where this is a real Blue Jays town if they're doing well. I mean, there's no guarantee of that, but there's a chance that the Jays are in another playoff sort of chase in September and kind of combine that with the newness of the event. And, you know, there's a lot of big events coming to the Toronto area next year with, you know, the World Juniors, half of it's going to be here. I still think we're going to get an outdoor game for the Maple Leafs. Some other things of that nature. So there's sort of competition for the sort of unique special event, you know, dollars that are at play in the city. And, you know, so there might be some empty seats. I was told actually, Greg, that Canada played a game with Russia in 2004 at the World Cup that didn't get sold out. So, huh. I mean, I don't remember that, but someone who was involved with that tournament told me that recently. And, you know, that is, you know, it just shows that it's possible it could happen again.
Your Blue Jays love reminds me. I have a piece coming out on Yahoo's baseball blog, Big League Stew, at some point.
Yeah.
They're doing a series called Homer History, and I picked the Joe Carter home run mainly because it gave me a chance to shit all over the Phillies as a Mets fan. But I look back at that, and what a fun ride for Toronto, right? Those 2 years.
Oh, it was. I mean, I was at the right age to appreciate it in that I had no other interests except sports, and I, you know, it was the best. It was, I mean, the reason why there's so much Jays love in the city of people who are in like 30 to 40 age range is that we were all kids for that period, and it's such, you know, kind of a foundation of good sporting memories, which people who live in Toronto and cheer for the local teams have a, you know, decided dearth of in the last 20 or 30 years. So I think that's part of why the Jays, when they do well now, you just see a lot of people kind of my age at those games just because it plays at our nostalgia a little bit.
Yeah, and the other remarkable thing too, like that the first Jays team that won and the one that won the following year, There was like remarkable differences in the roster for those teams. I mean, like you had the Dave Steeb group kind of winning that first one, right? And then like all of a sudden you had a bunch of other veteran players that joined up for that second one. It was really
remarkable. Paul Molitor, Ricky Henderson.
Yeah.
They were always an aggressive team, and I believe both those years they had the highest payroll in baseball. So they were kind of the Yankees of the era in the sense that they were unafraid to be extremely bold with their player acquisitions. And oh man, it was awesome. I mean, we had something similar this year with the Jays, I got to say. And you know, I'm not that optimistic about the immediate future, but if it ever happened again, Toronto would be a Jays town for a little while.
There you go. CJ, you're the best. Thanks for enlightening all of us on many things, and we will talk to you soon, sir.
Sounds good, Greg. Thank you.
Chris Johnston, ladies and gentlemen, at Sportsnet, an insider. I'll call him an insider. There's like five of them, right? So you got McKenzie, Dreger, CJ, Elliot, Kiprios. Is that five? I guess Cox is an insider now because he's on that insider trading or whatever the hell it's called, whatever the hell Sportsnet calls it, the smarty pants desk. Headlines, is it, Sam? Thanks for staying on brand. Headlines with him and Elliot on Hockey Night. Sam, am I missing anybody on the insider list? I think it's like six.
I can't keep track of all the insiders.
It's probably about six, maybe. And then you have guys that occasionally break news too. But I'd say it's about six insiders. And then here in the U.S., for whatever reason, NBC decides the best way to do it is to borrow Canada's insiders for its coverage rather than developing their own. Which I never really understood. One of the fundamental differences that I have with NBC and I have with some of the coverage on NHL Network is like, you clearly need to pitch it differently to a U.S. audience, right? And the idea that you're not going to develop your own voice, your own inside voice, the guy that you trust for news, your own Mike Florio for the NHL, and instead you're going to borrow McKenzie and Dreger. Like, I understand they're the gold standard. And I know that's what Sam Flood and NBC are thinking. You know, get the best. Why try to create an inferior imitation when you can just fly the best down to Stanford every week for them to do their video hits? And I'm happy that Dreger and McKenzie are making that kind of bank. But at the same time, like, the idea that U.S. fans don't have their own person to point to. Like, if my old colleague Nick Kostanica, by the way, like, was drafted by NBC to be, like, their television insider, he'd kill it. He would kill it. He's well-liked. He's well-connected. He could be on the air. He could tell you what you need. He could speak to American audiences. Like, that's part of the thing I never understood about NBC, why they didn't develop their own insider they could throw on the air and that we all relate to as being the voice of you know, rumors and gossip and talking to the power brokers in the league for the U.S. side. Never made sense to me. Couple more Super Bowl-y things I want to talk about before Lambert hops on. And I see people are telling me that, continuing to tell me how awesome the Stanley Cup is over the Lombardi Trophy. One of the things that always gets mentioned is the fact that the cup is handed from Gary Bettman to the captain of the team and how much people prefer that over Roger Goodell or whoever. I assume it's Goodell, handing it to the owner of the NFL team. I am not one of these people. I frankly have no problem with the owner getting the trophy. It's a really nice aesthetic and a really nice moment when the captain is given the cup first. That's fine. If it happened to be the owner instead who then hands it to his captain, I honestly don't care. I honestly don't. The dude, hey Sammy, give Lambert another call, by the way. He just said that the call went to voicemail. The dude, you know, puts up the money. He hires the people. He puts the team in place. I don't have as much of a problem with him getting the big trophy, from the commissioner as other people do in that situation. I know it's nice to have the captain hoisted in the air and all that stuff, but I don't care as much about that as other people do. Talked about Cam Newton. Feel bad for the dude. Think he's getting unfortunately maligned. It was a terrible game. It's overall just a terrible game. Like, all around. Amazing defensive play by Denver, and I didn't think they'd be able to repeat those conditions for a second straight game as they knocked Brady around 25 times. They did a hell of a job last night. Commercials, The winner of the ad meter was the Kevin Hart car commercial in which he uses his watch to stalk his daughter and leer at her, which I believe was also the plot of a Gerard Depardieu movie. The least successful ad last night, according to Ad Meter from USA Today, was the toe fungus one, in which I think it was, I want to say Deion Sanders, Boomer Esiason, and Phil Simms discussing their toe fungus, and then an animated toe with fungus on it is pitching a product. And for some reason, all of the people at home eating guacamole did not dig this ad, for some reason. Joining us now on the line is Ryan Lambert, a patriot, an amazing columnist. You could read his piece on Sidney Crosby today on Puck Daddy, and he joins us now to talk about a great many things. Lambert, did you watch the Super Bowl last night, sir?
I did not.
Is this because you hate football?
That is a big to-do with it, but also I was working and I was reading that book about the O.J. case that they turned that series into.
Oh, yeah. Who wrote that book?
Jeffrey Toobin is the
fellow. Right. Who also wrote the amazing book about the Clinton presidency and the Lewinsky investigation as well.
Yeah.
The book is great, and we talked briefly last week over Twitter about trying to do a podcast specifically for the OJ show, and I think that'd be a wonderful idea. The first episode of it was wonderful. I can't wait to see more of it. The moment I saw that Aikido with blood on its paws, I said to myself, "Okay, we're all in again for this."
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect because it's Ryan Murphy, and I don't really care for his stuff usually. Like American Horror Story, I'm all set with. Every review was like, this show is so weird and so amazing. And I was like, all right, I'll check it out. And like 5 minutes in, I was like, I'm pot committed to this one. This is it.
Yeah, I'm all in too for that one. With the Super Bowl, what is the thing that turns you off most about this event insofar as...
Well, the problem is they play football at it. and I'm just not a fan of the sport, really.
But
so
when it comes to this kind of spectacle with the commercials and everybody trying to advertise their product around the Super Bowl, including someone that can't even reference the Super Bowl because it's trademarked, so they have to call it the big game. What are your thoughts about the cultural impact of the Super Bowl?
Yeah, I mean, that's I feel like what most people watch it for is what it's become in, away from the football, where, you know, you're going to see Beyonce dance around and you're gonna and be great, apparently. I haven't seen it yet, but and you're gonna see the commercials. But for me, like, I can just do all that online. Like, a bunch of those commercials were online a week before the game, and like, I can just go to Gawker or whatever and watch every second of the Beyonce thing. So it doesn't really stand out as a thing I need to care about.
Right. And I watched that Beyonce thing with her and Bruno Mars and Chris Martin from Coldplay. And I was reminded of like, if I ever tried to get into the middle of a conversation between like Joe Sakic and Steve Yzerman, that's what I would have looked like Chris Martin last night trying to put on a show in between Bruno Mars and Beyonce. It would have looked about
place. They were very much like humoring his presence as the main guy.
Yes, exactly.
Like, even though it was the Super Bowl halftime show starring Coldplay, it was more like with Beyonce and Bruno Mars featuring Chris Martin occasionally.
Right, and they're like, you know, I appreciate that the Super Bowl decided to hire a guy, a Bono impersonator, to come on stage and evoke U2 at this point. That was very nice of them, but we don't really need him around. We're having a dance-off.
Yeah, and that's how it should have been, quite frankly. Let's be honest.
Let's be honest. Your point about the Super Bowl, though, I think is important, which is that it's no longer necessary to watch the game. Like, every commercial is released beforehand. The ones that aren't are released during the game. I watched the entire halftime show on YouTube because I happened to miss it. I mean, the game itself was garbage, and everything else you can just pick and choose. It's almost like the Super Bowl has become an a la carte type of experience, wherein other championships aren't the same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, it's never going to have the gravitas of the Stanley Cup Finals with its, you know, frog protection every commercial break. We're just never going to – they're never going to measure up to the sport of hockey in that way.
I do get excited when we're watching the cup final or something, or the playoffs or something else, and you see like Enterprise Rent-A-Car, for example, film a commercial specifically for hockey fans where it's like, now it's guys in hockey jerseys coming to rent a car. I always get excited because it makes me it's a hashtag please love my sport moment, but it makes me feel important that companies actually pay attention to the fact that they're advertising on the cup final.
Yes, three companies, and you're going to see that same commercial 700 times if you watch the first round and a half of the playoffs.
Well, listen, when it comes to sponsorship in the NHL, my bar is quite low. If you'll remember back when we were on Versus and before that the Outdoor Life Network, the intermission shows used to be sponsored by Waste Management Company. Remember that?
I do remember that, yeah. That is, boy, if that doesn't tell you a lot about the sport of hockey, nothing will.
John Collins walks through a door one day and says, boys, you know, not for nothing, but I think we may be able to get a beer company here.
In the future, guys, could we not have our product literally associated with trash? Just putting
with
that
trash.
One there.
Exactly. All right. Listen, I wanted to talk to you because we haven't talked about it yet, about the Wayne Simmons sucker punch incident with Ryan McDonagh. You and I are actually on opposite sides of this one, I believe, because you saw that play and you said to yourself, suspension, true?
Yes. Of course.
Okay.
I mean, they suspended Milan Lucic for the exact same thing.
Yeah, but that's because he's Milan Lucic. Like, they didn't suspend Marchand for the same thing because he was instigated into it by Landeskog. They haven't suspended other guys for sucker punches through the years.
Yeah, well, they should, though. Like,
no, I mean,
I'm always going to err on the side of, you know, if a guy concusses somebody else, like, given where this sport is going, like, just err on the side of caution. Give him a game. He's not going to care. It'll cost him like $6,000 or whatever. And then you can say, hey, we dealt with it. And then he's a repeat offender and you go forward from there. I just think that, you know, in much the same way that, like, you know, you watch any Ranger Penguins game and it's just Mark Stahl cross-checking Sidney Crosby in the back of the neck for an hour and a half. Like, it's crazy that this is allowed to continue to happen with no repercussions from the league.
I guess that's my serious
about headshots. Be serious about them.
I guess that's my problem with it, though, is that like it's so clear what set this down the path to Wayne Simmons taking a punch at Ryan McDonagh. And I do have an issue with sucker punch, by the way. McDonagh and Simmons are basically engaging physically at that point. And just because Simmons throws the first punch doesn't necessarily make it a sucker punch in my eyes. But it's Ryan McDonagh cross-checking Wayne Simmons on the side of the head that sets up this whole thing. And it's like, I get the idea that a sucker punch is something we demonize and he falls down and he gets concussed and it's terrible. But, like, just because sucker cross-check isn't something that's on the tip of everybody's tongue doesn't mean that it shouldn't be as heinous as what Simmons did. And you bring up the Mark Stahl thing.
No, I agree.
Again, it's the same thing. Like, he cross-checked the guy in the head.
Yeah. Yeah, there was that week where Sidney Crosby got cross-checked in the head twice or whatever, and I think it resulted in a grand total of one game of suspension. And it's I think that's a thing where the league can take a lot of stuff from the NBA's playbook, where it's like, hey, if you go after a guy who's really good, like a Sidney Crosby, they're going to come down harder on you than, because like nobody pays to see Jared Bowl play hockey, you know? And so like when Jared Bowl takes a run at somebody and he's a good player, like throw the book at Jared Bowl.
Yeah. And that's why I don't get Vigneault's comments today. Like on, again, if you haven't heard, Alain Vigneault today, decided to comment on this. He made one good point, which is that if the referee apparently skated over to him and said that Wayne Simmons was kicked out of the game for throwing a stick at the officials, which would really require, I think, the league to comment on it because that's a automatic three-game suspension. He's already played his next game. So that was a really bizarre thing. But the other thing he did was just something that makes me mental, which is he says, what I didn't expect was the reaction from the league. An all-star player gets sucker punched, goes down. I wonder if that's Sidney Crosby, what happens? Well, we know what happens. Nothing. Like, can we please
just... The guy on your team does it all the time.
Precisely. Like, can we just put it in the ground, throw the dirt on top of it, etch the tombstone on the Sidney Crosby is cobbled by the NHL idea? No suspension for Steckel, no suspension for Hedman, no suspension, you know, down the line, the guy gets abused, and he gets, never gets a suspension, hardly gets calls half the time, and that's why he's whining. Like, that, you know, Tortorella's always calling him sit down for whining, that's because he never gets any calls. So, like, of course he's whining. Yeah. The idea that you're gonna bring up Sidney Crosby as the paragon of coddling by the NHL in this situation is just asinine.
It's bizarre. Like, it's just such a thing where, like, Crosby has this reputation that he got from, you know, his age 18 season. The guy's 37 and a half at this point. We're still like, yeah, but he whines all the time. It's ridiculous.
I mean, he does whine, but he whines for reason. He whines because he doesn't get calls.
Yeah, well, here's the other thing. You know who else whines? Everybody. Literally everyone. So, I don't understand, like, what people think they can, like, get up on a high horse about here with regard to Sidney Crosby. It's crazy.
Yeah, listen, I agree. I think it sucks that McDonough got concussed. I just don't think this necessarily was a suspendable offense given everything that led up to it and given the situation itself. But if your argument is that, you know, all of these things need to be called more, and all of these things need to be disciplined more because of where we are as a league and facing concussion lawsuits and all that other jive. I mean, yeah, I think you make a fair point.
Yeah, and that was my thing with the Weidman thing too, where it's like, should he have gotten 20 games? Well, by the letter of the law, he should have gotten either 25 or zero. And I think that it was the league kind of splitting the difference, knowing it'll get brought down in arbitration and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, but you suspend a guy 20, 25 games for hitting an official, nobody's going to hit an official anymore. You know? And
what did
so,
you...
But now... Yeah, so...
What did you... What, I'm sorry, three games. What did you think of the Weidman situation? What did you think of, like, what do you think was happening there in your opinion?
He had a concussion and he just saw a guy, or he was, you know, zoned out and he didn't really notice until look, he cross-checked him in the back. Like, let's not say it's a shove, let's not say it's anything else. He cross-checked the guy in the back. And by the letter of the law in the NHL, you get 25 games for violent contact with an official or whatever the wording is.
Yeah.
And
intent to injure.
That makes sense. Yeah. I think that, like, you can't argue that you didn't intend to injure a guy you cross-checked in the back.
Yeah. I'm feeling you on that one. Alex Pietrangelo, by the way, out 3 weeks for the St. Louis Blues. Where are you on the Blues this year, by the way?
I think they're fine. I think they're probably like the third or fourth best team in that division, which is, you know, puts them a mile ahead of most other teams in the league. but I guess the Pietrangelo news means they're not trading Shattenkirk for no reason now. I don't understand.
Yeah, I never really got that either. Like, I guess, you know, we wrote about it when the rumors came up in the summer, and contractual considerations, I guess, are part of the equation. But it's also a case of, like, man, there's an oil and water thing that happened with him and Hitchcock, and I just don't see the idea of trading him when you know this is probably Hitchcock's last rodeo.
Yeah, and also, you know, you're not going to get the fair value for him. Like, you're not going to get a guy who's a forward who's as good as Kevin Shattenkirk, and you're not going to be able to replace him with anybody either, like, from your own D group that's going to be as good as him. So I just don't understand the motivation when you're, you know, fighting for a playoff spot and all that.
But what if he is Jonathan Drouin? He is as good or better than Kevin Shattenkirk.
Well, did you see, I can't remember who said it, it was like Friedman or Drager or somebody the other day was saying that, like, though they asked for somebody, like, relatively inconsequential from the Wild, and the Wild were like, we're all set for Drouin. And it's like, what? It was like on the level of a Nino Niederreiter. I don't remember if that's exactly who it was, but I was just like, I don't understand.
Well, are you somebody who thinks that Drouin's going to go and be a Sagan somewhere? Is going to just find his game and kick ass and take names?
Yeah, I definitely think that. I think he has too much talent not to do that. There are obviously, like, guys who don't live up to their draft status, but I would imagine that not too many of them put up like 180-point seasons in the QMJHL.
I got to admit, all this stuff gives me pause a little bit. Like, all of the stuff that's happened with him in Tampa, and it may just be a function of his relationship with Cooper, I don't know. But all the stuff that happened with him in Tampa dwarfs what happened to Sagan in Boston. You know what I mean?
Does it? I mean, obviously he didn't score like Sagan was a 30-goal guy when they traded him, which makes that trade even more insane. But, like, you know, the way they treated Sagan in the playoffs when he couldn't get a goal because he hit 13 posts or whatever it was, like, you know, they have him on the third line with Chris Kelly, and he's still second on the team in shots on goal. And it's like, well, maybe you take that information and you make a better decision going forward. Like, I just think that you're never going to get back a player who provides as much value as a Drouin does. Like, you're basically getting a, what is he, 21-year-old, like, top five pick.
But that's what I'm saying, though. It's like, I think in Tyler's case, it was pretty obvious that you had something really good there, and all you had to do was wait for some maturity, which may or may not have, like, we've talked about that before, you and I. Like, I don't know if that would have ever have come in Boston. But in Durant's case, this is all very, very hockey specific. It's all very much like, I deserve this shot, or I've earned this thing, or my reputation precedes me, and my agent says that, you know, he pats me on the head and says I'm a good boy, and I deserve to be on the top line. Like, there's a lot of that sort of, like, born on third base aspect to this dispute with Tampa that wasn't necessarily there with Sagan.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, and I think that that's why, you know, he's kind of made himself, like, you want to say Boston got hosed in a trade, For Sagan, like, Tampa's going to get almost nothing back for him. Like,
yes, this is true.
The Wild said, we'll give you Nino Niederreiter, and they were like, we're good. But it's like, yeah, that's what the market is. Like, you're going to get Nino Niederreiter. You're not going to get anybody who's, like, you know, a Louis Erickson. Like, you would be doing so well for yourself if you got anything close to an Erickson. So, I don't know.
Over in the Pacific, I wanted to ask you about San Jose, Anaheim, 2-3 right now. Is that what we're looking at? Because I picked the all California 1-3 before the season. Do you think San Jose and Anaheim are locked in there? Do you think there's still a chance that we could have a Coyotes team hop up there maybe and grab a spot?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on how long Mike Smith is out for, because as long as that happens, they're going to be fine. But no, yeah, they're... That's the three. They're the three best teams in that division by a lot. And, I don't know. I just don't see Arizona with its, like, 10 shooting percentage for the first 3 months of the season, like, sticking by that number. And they're not going to keep getting even probably decent goaltending. I don't super buy them as any kind of a contender. I think it's going to be the top three, the California teams, and then five from the Central and the West.
Two more questions for you, sir. The first is, you wrote about a little bit about Connor McDavid today. He's pretty good from the looks of things.
Yeah, he looks like he's all right.
How good do you think he could be?
I think he's probably Crosby. You know,
yeah.
He might. I mean, that was the hockey news cover, right? Better than Crosby,
and better than Crosby.
And I think that, you know, given the talent around him, if it ever coalesces into something usable, you know, if he can end up riding shotgun with Taylor Hall and Jordan Eberle, like, forget it, or Nail Yakupov, or the Nuge or whatever, like, that's a pretty scary group, and they're all going to be able to score on you. So that's more help than Crosby ever got in Pittsburgh. So it's very possible that he, you know, puts up similar numbers, which would, I think, be more impressive given the fact that, like, the save percentages now are like 916 instead of 910.
Mm-hmm. And finally, there was a little bit of controversy over the weekend. I dabbled in a subject I try not to dabble into because it goes nowhere. It's a real pissing in the wind argument about the national anthem and about Terry Fry, who's written multiple books about you know, things that are militaristic and things of that nature, saying that Chicago Blackhawks fans, when they go on the road, should not do their cheering the anthem bit that they do at United Center out of respect to the home crowd and out of respect to the song they play. What's your take on that?
Yeah, who cares? Like, this is just a song that he's like, well, I have to fill 22 inches and I want to have a thing to write on before the puck drops. So I can bang this out by the end of the first intermission. And he did it. I'm really proud of him.
But there's no doubt he believes it, though. Like, at the end of the day, I have a problem when people boo it, obviously. You just don't have to do that. But at the same time, like, when you're playing the, you know, Canadian national anthem in some city where they hate the team that their team is playing, you run the risk of that happening. But this is a complaint about people enthusiastically cheering the song, like, which my brain can't wrap around that. Like, I understand that there's a certain amount of, like, people that say that take the military approach to it and say, you know, hand over heart, stone silence as the song plays. But you're at a place that sells cotton candy and foam fingers. You're not at West Point.
Yeah, I think you know, you're gonna see him do it everywhere, and it's the whole thing of, like, this is just people in Nashville complaining when all the Chicago fans come down and wear their jerseys and cheer for Chicago instead of the Predators or whatever it is. Like, it's just columnists writing about fan behavior when they should be doing something better with their time and, you know, voice in the local market.
And you know, like, play the song. It's fine. I stand up for the song and do the whole bit. It's fine. But, like, don't sit here and pretend that, like, the national anthem being played up, like, 5 seconds before puck drop, and whenever they put the spotlight on the Army person in the crowd later in the game, that these are not pep rallies. These are pep rally moves. It's a chance for the crowd to pop. You never see, you know, a doctor put on the screen, you know, because the doctor's not going to make the needle move like someone who's wearing a uniform draped an American flag. Like, it's so, I got into it with some people over the weekend about this, and again, it's not to disrespect anybody's service or the people that sacrificed for this country, but you cannot sit here and tell me that you don't see how transparent this is, that in a third period, when a team's down by a goal and they throw the guy from the military on the screen, it's to get everybody cheering again. Come on.
Love it or leave it, Craig. That's what I said.
That's why I don't like talking about this stuff. And that's why I don't talking about it, because inevitably it comes back to my...
No, you can't be right.
And it'll always come back to my...
With the annoying guy, like, ooh, well, we should respect every aspect. But, like, it's the same thing at Yankee Stadium when they sing God Bless America and they wouldn't let you go to the bathroom.
Well, and that's my point. Like, that's the point I always come back to, is that, like, whenever somebody, you know, sits there and writes about how the fans should behave during the anthem and how, where their hand should be and where their hat should be and the whole thing, literally 5 feet away, within earshot of this song, there's some guy taking a dump. There's just this, because that's just what happens during the anthem. There's some guy just taking a dump. And what is he doing?
Buying beer. Yeah. All the same stuff that, like, that's the thing that's always been funny about it to me, that, like, people figure unless they're in their seats, they can just act as they normally would during that song. And so, you know, they're yelling at their kids, they're whatever, as long as they're on the concourse. Once you're in your seat, you that is where reverence must be shown.
And I am man enough to admit that that's me. When I'm at a Ranger game and I go up the elevator and I know that I'm running a little bit late to get to my seat in the press box, I crack a small happy smile when I know I'm on the concourse when that song is playing. Cause I don't have to stop what I'm doing for 3 minutes and listen to somebody croak out this song for the 100,000th time in my life. I'm so happy to be on the concourse where people can move about freely without having to worry about stopping in their tracks and playing freeze tag for 3 minutes. It makes me happy a little bit.
Yeah, how many times do you think you've heard that song? More or less than, like, Brown Eyed Girl? What do you think?
See, that's a tough one, because when I would go to Capitals games, you know, we would go to the Irish Channel afterwards, and all the time, whoever was playing the dopey, you know, Celtic music would play Brown Eyed Girl. So a lot of nights sure. when I would go to Capitals games, it'd be a wash. It'd be 1-1.
Yeah. I think that, you know, those are probably the two songs everybody has heard the most in their lives in the United States.
You don't think Sweet Caroline is past Brown Eyed Girl or no?
No, I don't. Brown Eyed Girl was like the big song for so long, you know, like it for the longest time, like it was the song most often played on the radio and all that kind of stuff. So I think for, you know, maybe 16-year-olds haven't heard it as much, obviously, like per year, but we used to hear it nonstop, it felt like.
Indeed.
As
all right, Lambert, thank you so much for joining us here. You have any thoughts on the potential retirement of Daniel Bryan tonight on Monday Night Raw?
I don't know who that is, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, sir, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks.
The great Ryan Lambert. You can follow him at Two Line Pass on the Twitters, and you can read him every day on Puck Daddy. Monday is What We Learned. Tuesday is NCAA stuff. Wednesday is the Puck Daddy Countdown, in which he ranks the stories of the week. Thursday is my new favorite column this season, Huge If True, in which Lambert digs his hands into the dung pile of a rumor and finds out if there's any validity to it. And then, of course, Friday is Trending Topics, a column that used to be about things on Twitter, but now is just on one subject each week. But we liked the name so much, we kept it. That's the show. Super Bowl, boring. Cam Newton, get off his back. Peyton, whatever. Commercials, meh. I'll say this about the commercials, because obviously I mostly care about the movie ones. I have no idea what the WB is doing with Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice. There was a commercial last night, there was two of them, about how Turkish Airlines will take you to Metropolis or Gotham City. And never a good sign when the acting by Ben Affleck in a commercial is atrocious. Does not portend good things for the film, methinks. Meanwhile, the Civil War ad for Marvel's next flick, it looked amazeballs. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, every year there's some commercial that is divisive, where I feel like I'm the outlier, I'm in the minority, as far as really liking it. It is not Don't Worry the Doritos one, which was just... but I did really enjoy the monkey dog baby, or baby dog monkey, or... Sam, do you remember did you get that commercial in Canada? The dog baby monkey, make monkey baby dog?
Unfortunately, in Canada, we do not get those commercials, so.
Alright, well, the one that I'm talking about was for some company, that had a creature that was a baby and a dog and a monkey all spliced together. And, I found it to
Might have been Mountain Dew, not 100% on that, though.
Oh, it was! It was Mountain Dew, because it was, about a drink that has caffeine, and then also fruit juice, and then also Mountain Dew in it. So that was what it was. Living up to their moniker of being extreme, I really enjoyed that commercial, and I pity the people that did not. And to answer your final question, no, I have not had a quesalupa yet. But in due time, I will. It will be mine. Thanks to Chris Johnston. Thanks to Ryan Lambert. Thanks to producer Sam. Thinking about you, Mr. Merrick. And hopefully reuniting the superpowers later in the week. All right, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye. ¶¶